Hey, deserving listeners, this episode is brought to you by Talkspace. Talkspace is an ongoing sponsor of the show, and they were not a sponsor for a number of months, and now they're back. So it'd be really great if you went to Talkspace.com and use the promo code Kirk. You have to use the promo code Kirk when you sign up. Not only does that give you a discount, but it also signals to them that you're one of my listeners, which means that they're more likely to continue that sponsorship, which is kind of a big deal for the podcast. Online therapy has its pros and its cons, just like in-office therapy does. I recently had Irvin Yalom on the podcast, one of my heroes. He's a hero to a lot of therapists. And he at first thought online therapy was ridiculous, but has since come around and is now not only endorsing and accepting of online therapy, but even works for Talkspace. He's some sort of contractor with them right now. So he's fully into it. And if that doesn't tell you that there's some value to it, I don't know what does. So if you're interested, you want to try it out. It's relatively cheaper than in-office therapy. So if you're looking for a therapist and you just want to see what it's like, I think it's, you know, definitely worth a try, particularly because we're having a sponsorship program. So go to Talkspace.com, use the promo code Kirk. The online therapist is a legit fully licensed therapist. They are trained in the mode of online therapy. And the difference with online therapy is you get to potentially talk with them every day or almost every day. And that frequent contact has its benefits, you know? And so if you're traveling a lot or it's hard for you to find a good therapist, the other nice thing about Talkspace, I would imagine, is like, if you don't really click with one of the Talkspace therapists, you can just ask for a different therapist on Talkspace, because it's, you know, it's just a matter of making that request, I think. And so that can make it easier to shop around, I guess, right? Anyway, Talkspace.com. Make sure that you use the promo code Kirk. All right, back to the show. Hey, deserving listeners, we had a great response to a recent episode in which we had Yuval on the podcast talking about evolutionary psychology, and so I thought I'd have him back. Welcome back to the podcast, Yuval.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Can you introduce yourself in medium length, Yuval, please?
Sure. So my name is Yuval Laor. And I have a PhD in culture studies from the University of Tel Aviv. I wrote about the evolution of the capacity for fervor.
Right. We talked about that last time, in which you explained how, I don't even want to attempt to briefly summarize it, but well, let me try. So we evolved a long time ago as mammals to have love for romantic partners and children. And as we developed language and the ability to think about abstract ideas, we soon, I guess, that love of children and romantic partners became directed towards ideas, and your dissertation was looking at the state of fervor in relation to that love of ideas and how it manifests.
Yeah, so fervor is the infatuated state, which there is an infatuated state for both romantic and parental love. But of course, we have many other kinds of love, child to parent. We love objects. We love our country. We love God. We love all sorts of things. But my argument is there's a new type of love, and one where the commitment is also to a set of ideas. The underlying emotion is awe. The establishment, the sort of the sudden falling in love, which doesn't always occur, but can occur in both parental and romantic contexts, is similar to religious conversion, the sudden religious conversion. There's also slow religious conversion. So that's what I wrote my PhD about, and what's what I'm writing a book about right now. So,
yeah, and the fascinating part about it to me that was enlightening is the idea that trying to convince somebody that their religion is wrongheaded, or their political opinion is wrongheaded, or their love of their country in a certain way is wrongheaded, is like trying to get someone to fall out of love with their spouse or their children.
Yeah, or it's a sensitivity to criticism. It's not falling. Yeah, it's as if you're criticizing their baby.
Right. They're right. It's like they're extreme. You know, we all know and expect parents to be partial towards their own children and to almost be blind to the negative qualities of their children. And yeah, that's okay. That's the way you want parents to be. Not yeah.
Well,
maybe
the blind spots can also, you know, lead people to make horrible mistakes in romantic context. So
right, right.
Yeah.
But we expect that and we accept it and we think it's normal. And yet when we see people having blind spots and sort of blind affection and commitment to ideas and political opinions and religions and whatnot, we think, why are you doing that? Just change your mind. You know, it's so obvious that it's wrongheaded. And what you're pointing out is that is, you know, it's akin to asking someone to turn on their own children.
Yeah. And it's many times it's a blind spot, but later it turns into willful ignorance where people don't choose not to see the faults in their ideology or their romantic partner or their children. So, and of course we can talk all day about that subject, and maybe we will, because I think last time I meandered around, didn't give it a proper systematic treatment.
Well, the topic is large and requires some meandering. You wanted to talk today about the handicap
principle.
Tell us about that.
So this is because you're interested in evolutionary psychology, and you recently did a podcast stating that you will not do any more about evolutionary psychology. This is an aspect of evolution and also evolutionary psychology that is concerned with communication as a specific subset of evolution, and that there's many specific dynamics that happen in the evolution of communication that are really interesting and fascinating and not trivial.
Interesting. Yeah. I want to hear more about that and how it relates to animals and including humans. But just a comment on I dipped into evolutionary psychology as a topic, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, and decided to make some podcasts about what I had found. And I thought back then that it would just be like, because I've made 700 plus episodes on various different topics. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it'd be just, you know, one of those other episodes that I made. But I got so much response and arguing with me and agreeing with me. And then people started contacting me to talk about different things on other podcasts and radio shows and comment on articles and stuff. And I just found like, wow, I didn't realize evolutionary psychology was such a hot button issue. So occasionally I keep dipping into it. And for the most part, a lot of people don't like what I say, because I kind of take a position that isn't as educated as yours, but similar to you. And I'm guessing, you know, you run into this too, where, you know, you're at a party and someone says, "Ooh, I read this article that we evolved to blank." And you just sort of roll your eyes, because you're like, I highly doubt that that's been demonstrated sufficiently to be convincing.
Yeah. And it's many, many misguided, just the whole framework. But it's the fault of many problematic theories within evolutionary psychology, which I think have been debunked and are not serious. But I just returned from a conference, the Cultic Studies, International Cultic Studies Association conference. And yeah, I heard in lectures, whenever people were referring to evolutionary psychology, which I'm all for as a subject, but they were always citing usually modularist, Kosmidis and Tubi, 92, a version of evolutionary psychology, which I think is just wrong.
So. Right. And from what I understand, all the top thinkers in what we could call evolutionary psychology and its various other terms will agree with that. They'll say that that model doesn't make any sense. It's too reductive. It's too separating from culture and epigenetics and everything. And so, and you know, it's complex. And so over time, I've made follow-up episodes and gotten in arguments with my co-hosts and, you know, been the bummer at the party or someone who's just biting my tongue. And so I got another email up from someone asking me to talk about evolutionary psychology again. And so I was just so fed up with my life in evolutionary psychology that I as a joke, mostly I said, this will be the last time we ever talk about it. But I was fairly certain we were going to talk about it again. And then I thought it was comical that it coincided with me publishing your episode directly after that episode in which we talked about evolutionary psychology. So,
yeah.
So I'm fine with it, but yeah. So are you ever at a dinner party or talking with friends or family and someone starts talking about evolutionary psychology and you have to make that choice as to whether or not you want to be the bummer?
Yeah, of course that happens. And sometimes it's even worse. Sometimes people, you know, believe in a thing called mimetics, which is completely ridiculous.
What's that?
Mimetics. It's a theory proposed by Richard Dawkins in 1982 on the extended phenotype, where he has his theory about how genes work, which is also debunked and completely not true. In any way, the selfish gene theory. And he argues that culture also functions in a similar dynamic to the way he imagines genes to work, and that they're it's like cultural atoms or cultural replicators, which are memes, and that they replicate each other, and that this is all explains all of culture.
That culture has evolved over time.
As a replication of certain ideas. So
instead of genes, you have memes.
Yeah, and the memes, they are also represented as being selfish. So if a meme, for example, might be a joke, and if it is a successful meme, that it makes the host, which is the person, tell that joke to others. So that's the replication mechanism or the of the meme that and that successful memes fight each other, and that culture is the comes about because of this fight between memes within our minds. But
right,
that is I can tell you many problems with that theory, but
I mean, just to give the listeners another example is the idea of how to, you know, build a building in the best way, you know, how to build a building, the strongest building. So a culture develops that technology and that idea spreads through, you know.
Many times canoes are used as an example.
The best. Okay. Right. So the best canoe competes against the less best canoe, and over time, the best canoe ends up being reproduced and the crappier canoe dies off. It's similar to competition with evolution and animals and plants and stuff.
Yeah, but it completely, and there are certain situations where that kind of algorithm, that kind of mechanism seems to explain it, but if you asked someone who believes in mimetics, why is England Protestant rather than Catholic, they would tell you that maybe the Protestant meme outfought the Catholic meme in the minds of different people in England. But if you ask a historian, they'll tell you that that's because Bloody Mary died of influenza, Mary the First, that is.
Right.
And that is the reason. And Elizabeth the First was a Protestant. And so you know, the only looking at ideas as if they don't interact with the world. And of course, the same idea would be accepted very differently if you're drunk, if you're a kid, if you've just seen a ghost, you know, all those and the source of it, if it's told to you by the Pope, if it's told to you by someone you trust, you don't trust. The idea that you can make an all else being equal argument regarding memes, that all else being equal, change the meme and see what happens, that you cannot make those arguments because the all else will not be equal. So,
and it denies power structure. Is that its main
authority? Yeah.
Authority. Yeah.
And it denies a bunch of things, but it denies the interaction between ideas in the world, ideas and emotions, for example. But you have people like Sam Harris who believes in mimetics. And so he will tell you that, you know, Islam is a collection of bad ideas. But of course, first of all, a person can believe with all their heart in a set of ideas that they don't know what they are, right? You can believe that whatever is in the Bible is true, but not know what's in the Bible. And you can take the most important ideas that you believe in. For example, if you're a Christian, you believe in the Bible says that you must give all your money to the poor. And yet you can very easily ignore that. There are many Christians who do not give all their money to the poor. And so this idea that memes or ideas determine our behavior and our explaining them and their biases is an explanation of culture is, you know, it's I don't know what to do with that. It's a ridiculous notion.
Yeah, I guess it's another example of someone who discovers something that's quite sound or that makes a model, a way of thinking that applies to a particular part of nature that makes a lot of sense, like genes and DNA and evolution. And then really loving that idea and extending it into other areas that it doesn't necessarily apply to.
But this is like a Platonic extension. So Plato would tell you that to understand the best way to structure a city, we need to look into the soul and that the city would be analogous to the soul for some reason. He doesn't give you an explanation. And this idea that ideas and genes will be analogous, you know, it just seems like a strange thing to assert and to extend it to such an unrelated or, you know, far different context. And of course, the claim is that ideas are replicating, but they're not replicating. They're often reconstructing many times. Anyway, there's...
Yeah, it reminds me of Murray Bowen. He's a pioneering family therapist. And he developed his theory of humans and families and psychology in his observation of the way families interact and how they have a, he developed this model of thinking that they're trying to balance two different forces. One force is towards each other because they want intimacy and closeness and love, and another force is away from each other in which they want independence and separateness and their own thinking thoughts and their own identity, and that families are constantly managing these two forces and trying to find a balance. And when you have a problem, it's often because something's off balance. And that's a pretty useful metaphor. A lot of family therapists find it to be useful. And then he extended it to the entire universe. he said that all of life is in this balance between going towards each other and going away from each other. You know, he called his theory, he didn't call it like family systems theory. He called it natural systems. And so he thought that all of life, you know, on the cellular level, and then you have cosmology and everything is moving, you know, it reminds me of that. You know, when I lecture about it, I point out that Bowen was trying to explain the entire universe, and you know, we always get a little bit of a chuckle. I mean, it's fine. It's a metaphor, but it just kind of reminds me of that you find something that's useful in your field, and then you just sort of apply it to the entire universe. So maybe that's what Dawkins was doing.
And Dawkins doesn't write about it. He proposed it, but ever since then, other people like Susan Blackmore and other write books, they write articles, but Richard Dawkins doesn't do so himself. So
tell us about a handicap principle again.
Okay, so sometimes this is also called, it's also sometimes called the Zahavi principle, named after Amos Zahavi, who passed away recently. He's the person that proposed it. He was also from the University of Tel Aviv. And he came up with a fascinating theory about the evolution of communication. And it starts with the realization that for communication, you need trust. And trust is not automatic at all. So if you take an example of communication between a leopard and an antelope, those are two animals that are trying to kill each other, right? The antelope is trying to starve the leopard, and the leopard is trying to eat the antelope. And yet they can communicate and trust each other. And they do that through what is called stoting, S-T-O-T-T-I-N-G. And stoting is when the antelope sees the leopard from far away, the antelope jumps straight up and does those hops. Now, on the face of it, that is the exactly wrong thing to do when you see a leopard. You should save your energy and not expend your energy, not even, you know, you're not even running away. You're just jumping straight up and down. But what that says to the leopard is that I saw you, right? So the antelope says that it saw the leopard, and that because it saw the leopard from far away, the leopard has no chance of catching the antelope. So if he started to chase the antelope now, they will just both get tired. None of them would benefit from it. And so it's best if they don't chase, and the same outcome, but saves energy for both sides. So the reason the leopard can trust this message that the antelope is giving him is because this display of jumping straight up and down is something that not every antelope can do. So if the antelope was sick, or if it was injured, or if it was tired or starving, then it would not be able to jump straight up and down like that. And so if the leopard sees a group of 30 antelopes and 29 of them are jumping straight up and down, and one of them is not, because that one might be sick or injured, it can be seen as the other antelopes pointing out to the leopard which one he should go after, right?
Yeah.
So the reason trust was able to be established in this case is because the display, the jumping up and down, is something that not every antelope can do.
Right.
Okay. So this has all sorts of different implications. I can give you another example that Zahavi gives before we continue of a falcon. I think it's a falcon. Maybe it's a hawk that is chasing two birds, and one of them is singing and one of them is not singing. And then they split away, that the two birds diverge, and the hawk will follow the one that was not singing, because the one that was singing could always stop singing and fly faster. The one that wasn't singing might be at the very end of its energy. So that's the one he would go after. So it's a paradoxical thing where you do something that is wasteful, right? Jumping up and down, exerting energy, or singing while you're running away from a hawk seems really the wrong thing to do, but we see it in nature and it makes sense in the context of the handicap principle. Now, let me just point out that the handicap principle refers to handicap in the sense of like when you play golf or if you play chess without a piece. It's that kind of handicap. It's not
disabled.
It's not disabled. Yeah, it's not people who are in wheelchairs. It's
it's handicapping yourself. So if
handicapping yourself and as that communicating.
Right, like boxing with one hand tied behind your back. That's
sure, exactly. So, yeah. So that's what the handicap principle is named after, and it's a problem because it's not a good name because of the. It sounds like you're talking about people with disabilities, but and there's other problems. The his book, Zahavi's book, is not. He's not a very good writer or popularizer of his ideas, which is a problem. And it's the reason why a lot of people don't understand the principle the way they should. So this principle, and in humans, we see that in what is called conspicuous consumption, right? So that's Veblen's a book from, 1900 or about how a human might buy a sports car, which there's no reason for him. He doesn't need a car that's just small, but it is a handicap. It is a display that not everybody can do. And so if you do a cheap display, for example, having a shirt that says, "I am rich," then anybody can do it. So it's not believed. Or if the antelope used the cheap display, for example, just wiggle its ears whenever it wants to signal to the leopard, it would wiggle its ear. Then that would be there would be no trust. You cannot trust that message because the antelope can do that all day. It's not a costly signal,
right?
And it's something that everybody can do, even if you're injured. So it's only things that not everybody can do will be impressive. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Now this is the beginning. So, for example, the tail of the peacock and the size of the tail of the peacock is given as the quintessential example of the handicap principle, where the peahens choose the peacock with the largest tail, even though that peacock would have the most trouble surviving because he has to carry around that enormous tail, right?
Right.
And so it can be said that the peacock tells the peahen, "Look, I am so fit that I could even survive with this tail."
Right.
Okay. Now, the other aspect of the handicap principle, and in the case of the peacock, this is a runaway process that can lead at the end to the extinction of peacocks, right? Because the tails would go bigger and bigger, and it would make them worse and worse at flying, and easier to hunt for predators. And so it can lead to extinction. But the handicap principle is about general communication in all contexts, not just this. And there is also the picture on the tail of the peacock, or the pattern, the colorful pattern. And that does not go bigger and bigger. That gets more and more specific. So in this case, the handicap is not for being the biggest, but being the most specific in a certain pattern.
Right.
So, for example, Professor Zahavi would say that if you go to a synagogue of Orthodox Jews, where they all dress exactly the same, they're all dressed exactly the same to be the best dressed person in the synagogue. So that, and this brings us to the first non-trivial aspect of the handicap principle, is that to show that you are the best, sometimes you need to do exactly what everybody else is doing. So to show that you're different, right? So, for example, if you want to show that you're the fastest sprinter in the world, you cannot run 87 meters. You must run 100 meters so that you'll be comparable to other runners.
Right.
So the handicap principle has a uniforming effect. It causes animals and displays to become uniform in various ways. So if you take the athlete, right, the athletes, we see three types of uniformity, right? To show that you're the best, you need to go to the Olympic Games. You cannot go, to the parking lot outside the Olympic Games and sprint there, because then... And you see uniformity in the athletes. So the athletes become very similar looking to each other. They all have, low body fat. They all have, similar musculature for whatever sport it is. You see a similarity in the displays, right? So if a Martian came down and saw a 100-meter sprint, they would think, "Oh my God, everybody did the exact same thing. That guy shot the gun and they started running and they all ran exactly the same." Or in gymnastics, sometimes the difference is just who sticks the landing a little better, or but it is the similarity that makes it possible to compare which makes it possible to determine who the best is.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And the third uniformity is the uniformity in the observers. So the people in the audience, they all are uniform in their knowledge of the rules of the sport, of the that they're observing, so that they know who they need to credit for being the best, right?
Right.
So the handicap principle, so that's one unusual thing, because the handicap principle is all about showing that you're different. Now, sometimes the handicap principle is about showing that you're good enough, right? There's also good enough displays, but you have those in evolution in general. In evolution, sometimes the fittest is the one that's selected, but sometimes you just need to be fit enough to be selected. So for example, if you there's butterflies who are poisonous and they need to resemble each other so that predators know to avoid them. And they just need to resemble each other well enough. So once, if you got the right color and the right shape, sort of, and you're good enough, then you would not be eaten. You don't need to be the best. You don't need to be the most precise.
Okay.
And so all the people who dress the same, right? If you look at the Academy Awards and all the men dress exactly the same, right? They all wear tuxedos. Some of them might wear it just to be good enough, right? So I wore a tuxedo, but some of them would wear a tuxedo to be the best dressed. So they and because a discerning eye could tell the difference between a, you know, $1,000 tuxedo and a $10,000 tuxedo. I assume that they can tell the difference.
Right.
And so the handicap principle explains why you have uniformity in displays. Does that make sense? Because that's a big thing. That's a big important aspect in culture, right?
Right. So it's not. So there's two kinds of uniformity. One is like we evolved to have feet for optimal standing and walking. So we all have, you know, 10 toes, or most of us do, and blah, blah, blah. So that's one kind of uniform form that evolves. But that's not the same as evolving a tendency to conform to a particular handicapping, you know, for, so when someone is displaying the best tuxedo, they're kind of putting themselves out. They're spending a lot of money to prove that they have a lot of money, or they're spending a lot of energy
to prove that
they have energy to spend on that such thing or something.
And that they're well-dressed and that they're of good taste, you know, so the wearing a suit to work, if you're, let's say, a lawyer, can be seen as a handicap. Now, with the handicaps, there's actually three types. There's one that's good enough, right? So everybody needs to wear a suit, so I'll wear a suit. Another type of handicap is when you're trying to be the best, right? So I'm running at the Olympics to show that I am the fastest runner. Not that I'm good enough, but that I'm actually better than everybody else. And the third is trying to do exactly the most precise thing. So that's not running at the Olympics, but that might be bowling, where you're trying to be the most precise, or throwing darts. You're trying to do exactly what you did last time, or what the prescribed best outcome is, but you're trying to match it exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements in Japanese art that and just general trades and occupations that create something. There's a long tradition of people trying to be the most precise and the most standard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to make a piece of sushi, and you have to make it in this exact particular way.
Yeah. The closest there's religious rituals that you need to do the most similar to some predetermined way to do it, you know,
right.
Sing the national anthem, right? Or
the masters of the tea ceremony in Japan are not masters because they put their own style into it. They're masters because they have mastered the precise prescribed tea ceremony.
And we'll get that to that later, because there is an element of creativity, and probably there is also in the tea ceremony, but that's within a context. So, we can get that in a second. But let me, before we continue, give you two more non-trivial examples of communication with the handicap principle. So one of them is soldiers coordinating in World War One that they will mutually miss each other. So people who are in different trenches, they're each trying to shoot missiles into the other trench, but they can, historically, we know that they would sometimes get agreements where we'll miss you and you'll miss us. Okay.
Right.
So that is, but for that, you need to communicate with the enemy, with someone who's trying to kill you. So the way this would happen is that they would take the best gunner, and that person would bomb a specific tree or rock that's by the other trench that is seen, and they would hit it again and again in a way that it is clear that this is not accidental.
Interesting. Okay? Yeah.
And so when you see, you know, the other side is bombing this tree again and again, very precisely, bringing their best gunner, the most accurate, to miss, then that might be a message that they're trying to give us. And so the other side would do the same. They would bomb the exact useless target, and that would establish. So,
did that happen in World War One?
Yes.
Interesting.
And it had to be broken up continuously by officers. So officers would break these things up. But what? Not anybody can bomb the same tree accurately again and again. So that's why the message carried a handicap.
Right.
So, because not everybody can do it, and it communicated worth. So that's one example. Another example is also from the context of war, is that there's a second century Jewish rebellion in Rome where the army, everybody to participate in the army, to be a soldier, you need to cut your pinky finger. Now, this is second century, so it's life-threatening procedure, but that seems completely contradictory to any common sense. Why would you cut a finger? Because, you know, we're trying to be the best soldiers we can, not mutilated.
Cut it off?
Yeah, cut it off.
Wow.
And that, first of all, if you're a soldier in that army, you know that everybody around you is really committed.
Right.
If they cut a finger to be in this army, they're not just going to run away the first, you know, bad thing happens. So you are very secure in the resolve of everybody in your army. And if you're a soldier that's facing that army, that is really scary. All of those guys are really serious. They're willing to cut a finger to be in that army. They're, you know, they're badasses. So it's actually a very... very useful thing to have everybody cut a finger.
Right.
Yeah, because it increases the solidarity. And of course, you have circumcision, which is a similar kind of thing. And there's many group rituals like fasting or that on the face of it look like they're hurting the people. But, you know, what's the use of having everybody fast? But it functions as a handicap. It communicates the resolve. It communicates the fact that people are really committed to this. They're not just here because times are good and they will leave the minute times are bad. So those are examples of handicaps, and they're all around us, handicaps. But then there's weird things. So for example, sometimes the same display, one display and its opposite can be a handicap. So having a BA, right, having finished a college degree is a handicap. It's something that not anybody can do, and it signals that you're, at least you can do that, right? And actually, a person by the name of Spence won a Nobel Prize in economics for saying this in 73. So, but not having a BA can also be a handicap when among professors. So if you have a bunch of professors, one of them can gloat that I don't even have a BA.
Right.
Right. And it's because you're compared to a different group. So in the general population, having a BA is something you can boast about, but it, among professors, not having a BA is something that you can boast about.
Because most professors have a BA.
Yeah.
So having a BA among professors doesn't distinguish you at all.
No, but not having one does.
Right.
Or not having a high school diploma. A friend of mine is a professor that doesn't have a high school diploma, and he can boast about that.
Right.
Because most professors do. Or if you're a Nobel Prize winner, you can boast about not having a PhD if you don't have one.
Right.
Right. So that's an interesting angle. And for example, Pablo Picasso would paint paintings that are seemingly very easy to paint, right? In the early 20th century, he painted and it looked like children's paintings, right? And people were outraged. People said, if a child can paint it, that's crap. But when they found out that Picasso was a master painter in every other style of painting, that he is a great master, and yet after that, he chose to paint in a way that's really easy to paint, then he became very impressive.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
So painting the way it is hard to paint, that can be a handicap. That can be a way to show off. But once you're a master, you can show off by painting like a five-year-old.
Right. A friend of mine is a artist, and he creates, I'm sure he's done a lot of different projects over the years, but his current thing is he, with a pen, he draws little circles on a huge canvas, and he draws little, like millions and millions of little circles, and it just ends up being, and he doesn't even try to make it into a image. It's just, it looks kind of like a dark abstract painting, but then you get closer and you just see it's just ink, and you see all these little circles, these tiny little circles, and he counts them as he does them on a calculator. He goes plus, 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 equals, 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 for the whole time. And to make sure that he has a count for how many circles. And so that's handicapping. It's signaling that he...
he does something that not everybody can do.
Right.
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 And this is
would tolerate doing or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And so a lot of art is very, very difficult to do, of course. And if it was easy to do, it would not be as impressive, unless, of course, it is by someone who already did the hard stuff that now. So
a lot of art is along these lines, is trying to signal that you're distinct in your ability to tolerate a particular activity that most, if not everyone else on the planet, wouldn't be able to tolerate.
Yeah. So that would be one aspect of it. Some of it is a talent, so that you're really, really good at motor coordination. So you can hold the brush in a way that other people can't, wield a brush. So that could be the handicap would be a skill that not everybody can do. But also the effort, of course, the holding the brush indicates the effort you put into practicing, a painting. But sometimes you can, in certain circumstances, you can also have show off that you did something simple. But you can show off that you're poor. If you're someone like the Buddha or Saint Francis, who come from a rich background but chose to be poor, then you can boast about it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And they do, of course, both Saint Francis and the Buddha are, showing off that they're poor. And that's only because they were previously rich, right?
So how does this relate, if at all, to evolutionary psychology and that conversation?
So, well, within psychology, communication is a big aspect of psychology.
Right.
Right. And so whenever you have communication, the argument is that you're going to see some aspect of the handicap principle. And many times that can explain or illuminate why people are acting the way they do. Now, there's an important point that needs to be made is that what I'm saying is that handicaps are done to impress others. But that is only their evolutionary function. That doesn't mean that the artist, for example, is doing what they do to impress, right? In evolution, you don't need to know why you're doing things. So you don't need to know that horniness or sexual behavior would lead to pregnancy,
right?
Or that hunger is tied to nutrition. You just know that you're hungry. So people can have the urge to create, to be creative. Sometimes they don't even display their art. Now that urge comes from the handicap principle. So it is because their ancestors who did act had this urge happened to have impressed other people and to have benefited from it.
So we evolved an urge
to be creative, to act in various ways that we also find impressive.
In relation to those around us in many ways.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that you're consciously doing it, or it doesn't mean that you're doing it to impress others.
Right.
It just means that it has evolved within that context.
Right.
But okay. If you ask why do people do art, you can say the handicap principle. Now, of course, that doesn't that explains things like artistic behavior, but also academic excellence, right? Trying to show off that you have a degrees or whatever, that you're educated. A lot of our motivations are tied to the handicap principle.
Yeah, I would say 99.9% of our motivation. I mean, every little thing, like the way your house looks, the way your landscaping of your house looks, your furniture, how thin you are, the kind of computer you
exactly
have, the way you talk, how tall you are, your hair, whether or not you shower, it's just like everything we do, the fact that we have a job, and
it can explain podcasting. The people who do shower or who do groom themselves, but it can also explain the people who don't groom themselves,
right?
The people who say I don't need to shave my legs, or a woman that would I'm so and that can also be a handicap.
Okay. Yeah, I just think of there's this one example pops into my head in my life. When I was growing up in the Seattle area in the late 70s, early 80s, everyone wore Levi's jeans. I've talked about this on the podcast before, but everyone wore the same kind of Levi jeans, the 501 red tag Levi jeans, everybody. Mm-hmm. And there was a time when I was in the fifth or sixth grade, and I did just a mental count of how many people at my school were not wearing Levi's jeans. And there was like four people, and I was one of those people, and I felt really inadequate. And so I begged my parents to get me Levi's jeans over time. They eventually did. And I went to school, and I was one of the conforming, I was that Japanese sushi artist trying to create precisely be fashionable. Yeah.
Or you're the guy who became a lawyer and had to wear a suit.
Right.
You're the guy.
Exactly.
There could have been that among your four people that didn't wear the jeans, some of you might have felt inadequate and you wanted to wear jeans, but others might have done it as a way to rebel.
I guarantee you none of us were in that category. We were all super nerds and had parents who didn't like Levi's jeans. And it wasn't long before everyone was wearing Levi's jeans.
So,
but then fast forward to like 3 or 4 years later, I'm in ninth grade in high school. And before school started, I just thought about fashion and just thought about how everyone is conforming all the time. Like everyone just dresses exactly the same, particularly the guys.
Yeah.
And so I made this decision going into ninth grade. I wasn't going to wear jeans at all. That was like one of the things, or I was never going to wear blue jeans. If I had, like, I had a pair of pink jeans, I had a pair of white jeans, and they were very weird looking, And so I just extended that all the way through high school, in that I took pride in saying that I never wore a pair of blue jeans in high school the late 1980s, at a time in my community when 95% of boys and girls were wearing blue jeans. I flipped from trying to conform as a way of handicapping to trying to stick out, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what comes to mind. So that was me manifesting that urge that.
Yeah, that was the yeah. And the people who confirmed, they all dressed the same to be the best dressed person.
Right.
You know, Michel Foucault gives an example of at some point in the 19th century with the Victorian ethics towards sexuality, people stopped talking about sex, right? And when they did that, there are certain people who did talk about sex, and they were suddenly, now they're avant-garde, they're rebels, they're dangerous, they're outsiders, they get all this credit for doing something that, you know, everybody did before, right?
Right.
Just because of the situation. I, for example, when I lived in Israel, I'm an Israeli, and now I live in Colorado. But when I lived in Israel, I was pro-Palestinian and a draft dodger. And there was a camaraderie among the left, among people who thought that equality is a good thing. That it, just in America, if you hold those ideas, then you're just a regular person. But in Israel, at the time and today, you're a rebel, you're an outsider, you're avant-garde. And so you have this convergence to culture or being different dynamic that I think is rooted in the handicap principle.
In an attempt to gain sexual attention so that we can procreate?
Yeah, so that is one kind of communication, right? Communication between the sexes. Or earlier I talked about the communication between predator and prey, right?
Right. So what are we doing as humans when we're distinguishing ourselves or trying to conform to something perfectly? What are we trying to get? Are we trying to procreate? Are we trying to protect ourselves? Are we trying to gain the...
Well, first of all, we might not know.
Tribe or something?
We might not know, right? So the handicap principle doesn't mean that you know why you're doing things. But yes, the reason why we conform to society, right, is to be successful at work, to be successful, you know, to be liked by other people, to be sexually attractive, the regular drives that people have. But the also being beautiful is a handicap. So that's not clear. I mean, why just being pretty, you know, not beautifying yourself, but for Zahavi, and this is not trivial. A lot of people who write about the handicap principle don't understand this nuance, or don't talk about this nuance. Is that in general, the way Zahavi talks about it, and I think he's misleading because he himself would contradict himself, is that the handicap must carry a cost. Now, the problem is that the term cost is very tricky and non-trivial to define, because there's different contexts, there's different, you know, some people, for them to work out, is they pay a price. Some people love it, you know, so they don't pay a price, or, you know.
It must communicate a cost?
Well, it must be costly, and it communicates because it's costly. Now, that is the way that some people represent the handicap principle, but it's actually not the way we use cost in a regular sense. So doing exactly what everybody else is doing, for example, running 100 meters at the Olympic Games rather than running 92 meters at the parking lot, that doesn't seem like there's a cost to it. But anytime you do what everybody else is doing, you are opening yourself to comparison. And when you open yourself to comparison, you risk being compared poorly. And so in that sense, running the 100 meters, right, wearing the tuxedo to the Academy Award, can be seen as a cost. It's because you're now opening yourself to comparison.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think about people who go to dance clubs or something, nightclubs, just being there, they're displaying a cost that they're allowing themselves to be compared to other people in the nightclub, you know, if it's a meat market kind of a place.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. So In a sense, we would not call that costly, but within the context of the handicap principle, being similar to everybody else and therefore comparable is actually can also be seen as a cost. Okay,
right.
So now we need to we talked about why all the men in the Academy Awards all dress exactly the same or similar to an outsider would think they dressed exactly the same, but they themselves would know that they dress similarly to not be the same. But what about the women in the Academy Awards? And there you see that what gets synchronized is not the dress, right? Because they're all dressed in different dresses, is that it's within a genre or within it's a nightgown.
Fancy dress with glitter on it.
Yeah, or whatever. But there what gets synchronized is a certain level of creativity.
Wow.
In the dress and certain love, but they cannot come dressed as a Chinese peasant from the 16th century, because then they would not be comparable in any way, right?
Yeah.
But they need to conform and wear a nightgown. But what they need is to be the right amount of creativity and flashiness in the nightgown, but that's not too much.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So
to be specific, as I am in high school and I'm not wearing jeans, mm-hmm. I am trying to signal.
So one of two things. So either you fail signaling that you can get jeans or you can get your parents to buy you jeans.
Yeah.
Or you're signaling that you're so cool, you don't need jeans.
Right. I'm above it.
Yeah.
I'm beyond jeans. I'm in the next phase of fashion or something. And I'm also trying to communicate a cost that I have the ability to spend time and energy in something that would be so much easier if I just wore blue jeans. I'm trying to communicate that I have extra resources to spend on fashion in this manner. I'm trying to communicate to other people, like, I've got my shit together so well that I can even spend a tremendous amount of energy in this kind of random thing.
Yeah.
And that makes me, well, I'm trying to communicate. I'm trying to get people to see me as someone who is either a sexual partner that they would want to have or someone that they should accept into their ranks because for tribal, you know, acceptance.
Yeah, they would want to be your friend or they would want to be you, you know.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But I'm not necessarily an antelope jumping up and down trying to communicate to a predator not to kill me.
No, well, the
although I will say I did.
If a bully beats up the people who don't wear jeans, then wearing the jeans is like the stoning, is signaling that I'm one of the ones that you know don't pick on me, pick on the other person.
Yeah, that's interesting because there were times when I would go to other. So in my community, I grew up in the same neighborhood my entire life. So no one messed with me, I guess, because they knew me. And mm-hmm. I don't know, for whatever number of reasons. I mean, occasionally I was bullied, but not in high school. But when I went in high school, I would go to other communities, other cities, and go to parties and stuff. And I would be dressed as a complete, so it wasn't just jeans. I would wear very strange outfits. And there was this one time I remember I was on Mercer Island, which is just a town nearby. And this humongous guy was telling me he was describing to me how he was going to rip my head off. He was like, I'm going to take your head and I'm going to smash it into that stove over there. And then I'm going to throw you out the window. And then I'm going to stomp on your head. Like he was just describing. And I just remember looking at him like, so at that moment, I guess we could get back to this handicap thing. I was trying to communicate to him that I was so tough or something that he wasn't making me afraid. I was just looking back at him like, oh, interesting. So then what would you do?
So
he was trying to signal everyone else that, you know, he's the, I don't know, some kind of super tough guy. And that he has worth in that way or something.
So in that situation, and this is another example that, that Zahavi gives, if you told him, if you talked back, and but you did it in a low voice, and that's a voice that only a calm person can speak in a low voice.
Right.
Right. If you're really stressed that he's going to beat you up, you're going to reply in a high voice. So if you said, oh, yeah, well, let's see you try. Or if you said, oh, yeah, well, let's see you try. Those are everybody can do the latter, which is why it's not impressive.
Right.
Only some people can remain calm and speak with a low voice.
Right. And I even took it to another level and I just tried to make a joke out of it. But I'm telling you, man, I was terrified. I was fairly sure
he was probably gonna... could not have spoken with a low voice.
Yeah. And I, and meanwhile, I'm trying to get the attention of my friends who are across the room. And I'm like, you know, so it was a conundrum because I couldn't let him know I was trying to get the attention of my friends because that would let him, you know, think that I was afraid.
And
so,
now, and another thing that you could do is that you can throw your arms back, you know, put your chin out and say, oh yeah, hit me, you know?
Yeah.
And that would be a handicap because that's the wrong thing to do, to give him
right.
a punch. Your hands
back. That explains that whole thing where people do that a lot. Like, go ahead, you know, hit me or
even in but that's why it's impressive.
Yeah.
And that you're the antelope that jumps up. Oh yeah, you're going to chase me. Oh, I'm going to get myself tired first. Let's see. And I'm still going to be able to run away from you.
So in that instance, and I was wearing a pretty ridiculous outfit that I don't blame him for trying to beat me up, but my speaking calmly and almost joking with him was me jumping up and down saying like, look, I've got so much calmness. I'm not afraid of you.
Don't go pick on someone else.
Yeah. Cause you know, would I be so calm if I thought I couldn't take you, you know, or I thought I couldn't hold my own, you know?
Yeah.
There was no way I was going to hold my own. That was gigantic. I mean, I'm a pretty tall guy too. So it's like he was just, I don't even know where he came from, but he was like the mountain kind of a thing. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So that explains a lot of behavior. You just explained a lot of human behavior.
Yeah. Well, an animal behavior. And he will show you that communication, that there's handicaps between in pheromones with, you know, worker bee communicating with the queen bee. I mean, there's a lot of different talk about the handicap principle, but a lot of people don't fully understand some of the nuances.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the same, but I remember reading about squirrels or birds that will show off by putting themselves in danger.
Oh yeah,
and
for sure
to signal to their fellow, you know, species that they can handle such a thing. They'll
So like that
bird will come down to the ground and sit next to a hyena or something, and when the hyena comes up, they run away, and they do it over and over again. You know,
the Zahavi, the guy who came up with this, he's a ornithologist, he's a bird biologist, and or bird behavior. He's a biologist, but he's a behavioral biologist. And he would observe birds that are not just that there'll be a bunch of them. They're trying to get closer. They're inching towards this hawk that is standing further away. And you know, he could not comprehend why would they get closer and closer to this hawk? What would make sense? But that's why he came with the handicap principle. So they're showing off to the other birds. Now, this ties into a bunch of evolutionary discussion regarding altruism. So if you have a bird that signals when it sees a predator, so it starts making noise, warning all the other birds that the predator is coming, that bird who makes the signal is putting itself at risk, right? When there's a predator around, you don't want to draw attention.
Right.
And so that was seen as altruistic behavior, and that was seen as, you know, Richard Dawkins or Hamilton before him would explain that as a selfish gene explanation, right? But with the handicap principle, you don't need the selfish gene. You just need the display to be observed and to have a credibility or a social hierarchy that you get. You impress your other members of the group by acting altruistically. Right.
Right. Right.
So if someone like Richard Dawkins or someone who believes in the selfish gene stuff would say that when two brothers are walking down by the river and one of them falls into the river, the other one needs to calculate how much relatedness they have, right, and the risk, and that would determine whether or not they jump after their brother to save him, right? I don't know if you heard that kind of argument. Right, there's nothing I wouldn't do for two brothers or eight cousins.
No, I haven't heard about that.
Okay, but that's the selfish gene kind of explanation. Now, Zahavi would tell you that if you have two brothers and one falls in, that's one thing. But what about if there's a third brother? Right, then that changes everything. Now you want the other brother to jump in. Now the math becomes very, very messy. But also, there's a big difference whether or not you're going to jump in or not jump in based on how many people are watching you, right? So if your altruistic behavior is observed and impresses other people, that's a very different thing than acting altruistically when you're not observed.
Right. So to me, it seems philosophically like it can all be tied back to, I guess, what I would phrase as a selfish gene, in that we're all trying to, you know, all these urges that we have are related to survival, right? And propagation.
Yeah, but that's a selfish person.
Of our genes, right? And so
that's not selfish gene. Selfish
gene
is not a selfish person. So it can be in the context of just survival, but in this case, it is also survival mediated through communication and reputation.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. You took the words right out of my mouth.
But that's a big difference between ignoring communication and reputation and with accepting that it plays a big role in this aspect of, you know, but of course it ties to survival.
And your idea, or this idea, is so much more complex but accurate than just looking at DNA.
Yeah, or saying that, yeah, we want to help our family because we share genes.
Right.
It's and hopefully if you think about the handicap principle enough, you'll start seeing it everywhere. You know, it's and also the nuances. So the Catholics can be proud that they have the prettiest churches, and the Jews can be proud that their synagogues aren't pretty. Right. You know, they can boast.
Oh, right? Yeah, I see it everywhere. Like I'm just looking at my window right now, and there's these trees that have been planted a long time ago, and they border between my house and my neighbor's house, and just how uniform they are and how well they've been trimmed and taken care of and planted a long time ago. There's a lot of communication in that, just looking at that,
you know, for sure.
And me for living here, you know,
mm-hmm.
The chairs on my deck and the style that they're in and the cushions that are on there that I, you know, that I can, have the sort of time to have cushion management. When it starts to rain, I have to take the cushions in, you know, like
I'll give you another example of the handicap principle from Zahavi. And he says that whenever he comes to work at the university, the secretary always says to him, hello. And she always says the same word, hello. And the reason she always says the same word and not the different word every day is that he'll be able to compare it. So because it's the same word, he can distinguish between hello and hello and various nuances on it. And so and he refers to this as the handicap principle. Of course, there is no real cost in the regular sense of the word for saying the same word rather than different words. But I mean, there is a cost because you're reducing your options in a way, you know. So, right. But the fact that you always say the same word.
The cost that you're revealing your inner thoughts.
You create a similarity, and that similarity allows you to see small differences. Just like the similarity in the tail of the peacock allows the peahen to see small differences.
What are the criticisms of this idea?
So he first proposed this theory in 75 and 77, and he was attacked as it doesn't work by John Maynard Smith. Actually, that attack was the thing that made anybody pay attention to it. But it was not considered to be legitimate when it came out until 1990. And in 1990, a person by the name of Groffin wrote a paper showing that mathematically, the handicap principle can work. Okay, so he did all sorts of mathematical models with various assumptions showing that, yes, this handicap principle can actually work. So since then, it has been sort of accepted, but it has been usually used to explain things like sexual displays, right? The animals that are dancing toward, you know, to each other, or that they develop large antlers or large tails, or, you know, very, very distinct colorations. So that was what... Now, the interesting thing is that one of the guiding principles that guided Zahavi is that he thought that a lot of biologists at the time in the 70s and that era, they had physics envy, which was very common at that time of in the world. And everybody wanted to do math. If you're a biologist that does stuff that doesn't require math, then you're not serious.
Right.
And a lot of models were built back then. That there were all sorts of evolutionary stable strategies where, you know, certain models that at the end they don't help us because they assume, for example, that an animal can either be a hawk or a dove. But animals are not either or. They can decide at different times, and they can, you know, they have intelligence, you know, the stuff that's hard to model. So he was driven by a backlash against this math at all cost, right? We must do math if you were serious. And he could not do math also, as many people can't. But he thought that it's fundamentally misguided to think that we must, biology should resemble physics in this mathematical reduction, low, smallest scales, you know, looking at the genes, looking at molecular biology being better than, you know, zoology, for example. Right. So he was against that, and yet he became legitimate when a mathematician showed that that he can build models that can show that the handicap principle work.
Well, and it's sort of absurd too, because as you said, he developed a mathematical model with a lot of assumptions, right? So you would have to say, like,
Groffin did.
Yeah, assuming that, you know, I don't even know how to model. I have it sort of abstractly in my head, but it's like assuming
He defines cost as a reduction in fitness.
He what?
He defined for his model to prove the handicap principle. He defined cost, the handicap, as costly, and that cost as a reduction in fitness.
Right.
Right. So having a large tail reduces your fitness when compared to the animals that try to hunt you.
Right.
So it increases your fitness.
Has to increase. Right. There has to be some net gain in the equation. Right.
But the problem is that fitness is different in different contexts.
Right. It's
so sometimes having tattoo is increases your fitness, but sometimes having tattoo decreases your fitness.
Right. Right.
Sometimes drinking vodka increases. Right. So it's not, the fitness is not inherent into the signal.
And there's no...
It's signal plus context that determines fitness.
Right. So I guess you could have that simple equation, you know?
Yeah. But so I'm critical of the mathematical proof that the handicap principle works.
Right. Because
I think it works regardless of the mathematical
model. Yeah. It's because... I'm guessing that, you know, the model that helped make it legitimate, quote unquote, had all these assigned numbers and, you know,
and graphs and
And it's just like, how do you know what the mathematical weight of a particular factor is?
There's a problem of combining handicaps, right? So if you have 100 different handicaps, there's right. Your nose is pretty, your eyes are pretty, your hair is pretty, but you need to combine those. Anyway, there's, it's not that easy.
Right. Yeah. There's a similar problem in psychology, and there has been in physics envy and this.
Oh yeah. Physics envy was big. Actually, I think I wanted to talk to you either about the handicap principle or the new atheists or, you know, maybe the neoliberals, but I think that their story is much more influenced by the physics envy, which is, I think, very, very problematic.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that next time. What do you say?
Yeah, for sure.
Yuval.
That sounds good.
Well, thanks for coming on the podcast, Yuval. This has been fascinating.
No problem.
Where can people find you on the internet?
So I am on Facebook and Twitter, but I do not really participate. So you can message me there and I might see it. You can also email me at yuvallaor@gmail.com. That's yuvallaor.
At gmail.com. Yeah, I encourage people to email Yuval. He is interested in what everyone has to say, as I am. And you can email us at contact@psychologyinseattle.com. Your book is going to be titled what?
So the current title is The Awe-Inspired Primate.
The Awe-Inspired Primate.
Yes.
Well, thanks again. You've also been fascinating. And when we have you back on in, I don't know, in a few weeks or so, we'll talk about the new atheists, which I have no idea what that has to do with. And I'm fascinated to hear your thoughts on it.
Okay.
Everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really do.